right, I'm going to try to finish this today. And try. And then we may take a, if you're doing study and you're studying something and there's something that needs further attention, usually what they'll do is they'll put an excursus, sort of outside writing after. So we may do one of those next week, and then we'll think about where we're going to go after that, which I have no idea where. So, but that's not bad either. All right, so we're looking at this idea here. Coming back to, let me back up here. This notion of partial hardening has come upon Israel. And then last week we were finishing up with this idea. So that partial hardening comes until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. So the word until is a word that we understand in English in different ways than it gets used, particularly in the Greek word for until. And so what I want to do is sort of look at that. But in order to do that, we need to first look at this notion of hardening. The hardening that has happened to part of Israel, according to Romans 11, fits into the historical outworking of this notion of election and reprobation. There are only two types of people in the world. You understand that? Saved and unsaved. And so as God speaks to us in that context, we need to sort of remember that. He doesn't, the Bible, though it talks often about Israel, though it talks about Judah, that is most often simply a way of referencing God's people. And it often, in the scriptures, included more than just ethnic Jews or Israelites. In fact, two of the perhaps most famous non-Jews end up in the lineage of Jesus. Who are they? Rahab is one, and Ruth. Two non-Jews who are part of Israel. They're part of God's people, brought into the people of God. So this use of hardening fits into that notion that God has two people, the saved or elect, and the reprobate, those who are not saved. We're not going to get into too much God's role in both of those per se, but I think it's important for us to understand here. The hardening refers not merely to hard-heartedness on the part of Israelites, but instead this whole mystery of election that gets, I'm in your way, Cindy, anytime you use the word election and you're talking to a fellow believer, you run the risk of being misunderstood, right? Oh, you're one of those. Whatever those are, I'm one of those. And it's interesting. And so there is this attending mystery to election. From among all the people who are dead in their sin, God in his sovereign grace elect some. And we want to figure out, on what basis does God elect? And the reality is, we have no idea. Not many are wise. That's all right. Well, it could be. So the idea here is that people they say they agree with election, but when you actually and the reason for that is, if you believe the Bible is God's word, the Bible says God elects, right? So at some level, you have to say, well, of course, the Bible teaches election, but many in evangelicalism particularly, would say that he elects based on some foreknowledge of him looking out into the future and seeing that you are going to respond to the gospel, and so he says, oh, I see him, he's one of mine. Rather than seeing, oh, I see a dead man floating out in the sea, I can make him alive, which is what election really is, right? I mean, that's this notion of taking that which is dead and making it alive. God in his sovereignty, in his sovereign election, has elected some to everlasting life, while the rest have been hardened. And this notion of hardening, it's seen from two perspectives. Since hardening has always been part of God's work of salvation, one should pause before asserting too quickly that it will cease. And that's that we're getting back to this notion of until the fullness of the Gentiles, right? Israel will be hardened, a partial hardening, until. So what I want us to see is that we can't just automatically say, well, at some point the hardening is going to stop. That's the use of this word until here. The text doesn't make that assertion. The text does not say hardening shall cease in Israel. It never says that. Why wouldn't it say that? How long are the hardened? Eternally. So to all of a sudden say, well, but this people, hardening is going to stop. Okay? You following with me? So the text doesn't declare that this overarching principle of God's election of some and hardening of others won't have an application to Israel in this future time, whatever that might be. So let's look at this then. So instead, the text affirms a continuation of hardening within Israel throughout the present age, which we see. We see that in Israel. We see that in Gentiles. We see that in our neighbors. I was talking to someone. I went out to get the paper this morning about 10 till 7, and my neighbor was coming home. And I was wondering whether he works nights or whether he just had a long night out. We see that a lot. My daughter nannies for a family that they're having a birthday party for one of their children today. It starts at 10 a.m. If you have small children and you sign them up for sports in most communities, when do they play those games? Sunday mornings. There's no guard. There's no sense of we shouldn't do this, right? And that's true here, that this hardening is going to keep going. God's decrees of election and reprobation continue to work themselves out in history. As a sovereign distinction was made between Jacob and Esau, so throughout the present age, hardening will continue. What did God say about Jacob and Esau? Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. And you look at Esau, what happened to Esau? This is important. What happened to Esau? He became a great nation. Remember when Jacob came and was afraid to meet his brother because his brother had just amassed this tremendous wealth? God had blessed Esau. God had loved Esau in that sense. So when God says, Jacob I loved and Esau I hated, it's not in this context of just, oh, God just hates them. It's in the context of election and reprobation. God chose one who was not worthy of being chosen. Why did he get his name? He was a deceiver. He was a cheat, right? I mean, the glorious story of election in the Bible is not that God chose those who were great and wonderful and because they weren't. You know, I always sort of cringe when you get to Hebrews 11 and it is often called the Hall of Fame. And I say, well, we should really call it the Hall of Shame, There are murderers, adulterers, just all sorts of scoundrels in that. The notion is that God elects. God takes that which is dead and brings them to life, calls them out of that life. So what about the future then? And that really is, so if I'm reading along in Romans 11, I'm reading it primarily in the context of Paul is speaking to a primarily Gentile audience to let them know about what is happening within Israel or the Jews at that time. I'm not reading it as if, oh, this has absolutely nothing to do with the Jews of Paul's day. This is about some future time off in the distance that nobody really knows when it is, but it will be a literal 1,000 years. And so I start plugging all of those things into that context. So the answer to that question, what about the future, hinges, I think, on what is the force of this word until in Romans 11:25. The use of the word until indicates either, it can be two things. Either it talks about matters up to a certain point, until, or until a certain goal is reached. I don't think I put this in, we're going to look at some examples in the Bible in a minute, but one of the best ones that that helps us to understand this. God will make, will give Jesus a footstool, make the earth a footstool until when? Do you know the rest of that? Until he makes all his enemies bow down to him, essentially. All right, and so we would read that and the question then is, does Jesus then give up his throne when all of his enemies are defeated? No, it's the word until is just saying that something has to happen. This, a goal has to be reached, okay? And I think in the passage that we have before us in Romans 11, it's clear that the second sense of the word is the way that Paul is using the word until. Until a goal is reached. It doesn't mean that something is going to stop once the goal is reached. It just means that this section relates to a time when this goal has not yet been reached, but it will continue after the goal has been reached. Okay? I hope I'm not making myself unnecessarily unclear here. I guess in the grand scheme of things, it does not determine what the state of affairs will be after it is concluded. I can't read this passage and say, aha, therefore hardening will stop, right? Israel will experience a partial hardening until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. And so once I figure out what the fullness of the Gentiles is, then I can say, well, the partial hardening will stop. And I'm arguing, you can't make that case. He's simply saying there's a goal, and that word until pushes us to a goal. The real force or thrust of that passage is the fullness of the Gentiles, not the partial hardening of Israel, which is what most dispensationalists would make this passage about, right? Because Paul, who is Paul talking to? Gentiles. And so the force and the thrust of the passage is about them. But it relates not only to them, but also to Israel, to the Jews, because Jesus came to whom first? The Jew. And so the relationship that God has with the Jew was first, and then because he came to the Jews first, that message of the gospel goes out to the whole world, to all of the Gentiles. All right? All right. Let's look at a couple of places where this word until is used and see if we can get a better handle of this. Hebrews 4:12 says that the sword of the Spirit pierces until the dividing of soul and spirit. It doesn't indicate at all that the piercing will stop once the soul and the spirit are divided. It just, that's the goal. The goal is to divide soul and spirit. I think rather it indicates that the dividing will continue as far as possible. It's going to keep going because it's necessary. The until does not indicate that piercing ceases again, but that it will go as far as possible. The until, if there were any possibility of a deeper piercing, the process is going to keep going. All right, so we can't just read that word until and say, oh, it'll stop. Now, in the case of the spirit or the word dividing soul and spirit, it will come to an end. When? When Christ comes back. Because we will be, all that is a part or a remnant of that old man will be finally done away with. And there will be no need for that piercing work of the sword of the Spirit. Then the word becomes more a context of living righteously in this new heaven and new earth. Okay? Because there's no more divided, I no longer have a divided heart. Right now, we all have divided hearts, right? We do. We all have them. And so we need the work of the Spirit to separate those, if you will. Next one. And this one comes in the context of Jesus talking about end things, end times. Matthew 24:38. The people of Noah's day ate and drank until Noah entered the ark. Did they go on a fast the day that Noah went into the ark?
Well, yeah, there wasn't any sense of eating.
Again, the thrust of this is not the eating and drinking. The thrust is Noah entering the ark. And the point that Jesus is giving here is, look what they were doing. They were indifferent to God's plan and purpose. God is telling them, I'm going to judge the earth, and they just go on eating and drinking. And they kept going on eating and drinking even after Noah went into the ark until the waters came and destroyed mankind other than Noah's family. Next one. This is another... Oh, there we go. This is another one of those end time passages, if you will. Paul talking about chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians is this great discourse on why the resurrection is important. Because if Jesus wasn't raised from the dead, we are without hope in the world. And to be pitied among all men, that's Paul's argument. Either Jesus rose from the dead or this is just silliness that we're doing. So in 1 Corinthians 15:25, Paul says that Christ must reign until, oh, I did put this in here, until he has put all his enemies under his feet. And again, the point is not that a day will come in which Christ will no longer reign. Do you see reading that word until as if it means something's going to stop? That he will reign until all of his enemies are put under his feet. And if I read the word until like I want to read it in Romans 11, then I would say, well, then Jesus stops ruling. And one of the, we all know the chorus line in Handel's Messiah, and he shall reign forever and ever. So he doesn't stop. It's just, again, the goal is that all of his enemies are trampled under his foot. And we understand that death and Hades are the last great enemy that we have. All right. So, there's no indication by itself that the partial hardening happening to Israel will somehow be lifted, that somehow it'll stop. Somehow Israel, though hardened partially now, whenever this fullness of the Gentiles happens, that all of a sudden Israel is going to turn its attention to God because they're no longer being hardened. Okay? And that leads, I think, to the crucial word, the crucial words in Romans 11:26. We'll just keep going. And so all Israel will be saved. So the question then becomes, what is all Israel? What does Paul mean when he says, and so all Israel will be saved? So the question is whether ethnic Israel has a future that will be different from that which Israel experiences during this gospel era time. Jews have been saved and will continue to be saved during this time. Chris Knabel, who you all have met, he's the church planner we support in Sarasota County. His wife shared a story. I'll see if I can find it and share it with you all. Chris's great or great great, one of those two, grandfathers was a Jewish rabbi. And the word of God pierced his heart and led him to believe and trust in Messiah, in Jesus. It's a marvelous story. I'll try to remember to share that with you all. So Jews are being saved all throughout this gospel era. That's not in dispute here. The question is whether verse 26 speaks of a distinctive conversion of God in ethnic Israel, either immediately prior to or in conjunction with the return of Christ. So at this time when Jesus either swoops down, scoops up the church, takes them off to heaven to enjoy this banquet with him, this wedding feast of the Lamb in heaven, and we have this great tribulation on earth, it's either during that period of 7 years that Israel no longer is hardened and now looks to Messiah, or when Jesus does return to earth for that 1,000-year reign, during that time, Israel no longer hardened, now looks to Jesus as Messiah, okay? So those are that's really the question before us. It has often been, I think, read wrong, and then all Israel will be saved. Israel will experience a partial hardening until the fullness of the Gentiles shall come in, and then all Israel will be saved. You see the force of that word then. As I tell people often, words matter. Words matter. And so if I read it this way, then all Israel will be saved. I have made Israel a distinct entity, a distinct body. But the problem is, that's not what Paul said. He didn't say, and then all Israel will be saved. He said, and so all Israel will be saved. If I put the word then, it's as though there was a temporal aspect. Hardening has happened to part of Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, but then after that, all Israel will be saved. Yes, Cindy.
Is that why so many people are on this big, Israel thing, and they're saying, well, if you really
That is correct.
Israel is not everybody
that is Jewish is going to be in heaven. That's right. Not all Israel is.
So I guess because of this, so many of them are of the mindset that they're going to be once God's Gentile people come in, then all of Israel will be saved. So we have to protect them and make sure that everything is wonderful for them.
Okay. Did you all hear that?
Because I've been thinking about that.
Cindy just made my case for me here, okay? Well, no, what I'm saying is, so much of evangelicalism reads it this way, and then all Israel will be saved, as if God has a different plan, a special program for national Israel, and therefore it is incumbent upon me, an evangelical, to support Israel no matter what. And I don't see the scriptures warranting that. When Israel does something heinous, we ought to call it heinous. We are not looking for a temple to be built in the city of Jerusalem and Israel coming to it and worshiping and offering sacrifices again at the temple, because the temple already came. Jesus, that's right. Yes, John.
Set aside for us being
No. No, I'm not saying that. What? Right.
Now, you're saying that we're using Israel in two different senses here?
That is correct. And I'm going to, if you can hang in there. Yeah.
I'm talking about ethnic Israel.
Yes. I would say, let's see if I can put this in. Let me first say, so John is asking the question, am I saying that God has no special plan for Jews, regardless of whether that's now or in the future, and then is Paul using the word Israel in different senses, okay? So the answer to the first question is, I'm not saying that God doesn't have a plan for the elect Jews. You need to be very careful about hearing what I'm saying. God has an elect group of people within Jews, just like he has an elect group within Gentiles. And in both of those cases, do we have any idea who they are? No. Paul has already said in chapter 9, not all Israel is Israel. So then to all of a sudden say, but here when he says all Israel, oh, it has to mean every single ethnic Jew. And that's just ridiculous. It is that, and depending on your view, some might argue that much of what Paul was talking about actually did come to fruition because there was a rather large Jewish group that came into the church at the time just before Jerusalem fell. So you could argue that Paul was looking for that. There are others, and I'm of this opinion that I think before Christ returns, there will be a large number of elect Jews who will look to Jesus as Messiah. But what I'm saying is that has nothing to do with national ethnic Israel.
Politically.
Right. Political Israel is just another kingdom of this world. And what does God say about every kingdom of this world? It's going to go away. It's going to pass away. Because there's a greater kingdom coming. In fact, Jesus said it already has come. The seeds of it are already here and it's already at work. And there's this glorious kingdom that might have 2 or 3 billion people on the earth in it. That's a pretty formidable force, isn't it? We don't think in those kinds of terms, I think, enough. We read words like Israel and we say, well, it's Israel. Therefore, it has to be national, ethnic Israel. And Paul makes the point that, well, not all Israel is Israel. So something, this means something else. Did I answer your question? Okay. I'm going to not answer. All right, where am I? Nope, here. The ESV tries to help us, as John just read, when it translates this, and so, the ESV says, and in this way. So the translators of the ESV, which I think is the exceptional standard version, by the way, it's wanting to help us to understand in this way, that is Jew and Gentile together are constituting this new body of Israel. Okay? So in the manner prescribed, saving and hardening, which is the only way that God works. He either saves or he hardens. And you can argue, well, is he active in his hardening or passive in his hardening? The Yes, Andy answered the question correctly. The answer is yes. Some individuals he hardens intentionally. We see that in the scriptures, right? The first real poster child for hardening was Pharaoh. Now, was Pharaoh responsible for his own hardening? Yes. In fact, in Exodus, we read that Pharaoh hardened his heart. We get to Romans 9, and Paul says, God hardened his heart. And the next poster child, there were plenty of others in the Old Testament, but the next real poster child is Judas. And the question is, who hardened Judas's heart? And the answer is Judas and God. Because God was orchestrating and ordaining everything that happened in order for us to be saved. And in order for us to be saved, Judas had to betray Jesus for 30 pieces of silver because he had prophesied that in Zechariah. And that through that hardening of Judas's heart, redemption would come to humanity. Okay? So we really need to identify all Israel. What does Paul mean when he says, and in this way, all Israel will be saved? Five possibilities. Number one, all ethnic descendants of Abraham. Okay, so what I've argued so far, would that be a good option? No, that's not a good option at all. Two, all ethnic descendants of Abraham living when God initiates this work among Israel. Okay, I've made the argument that can't be either, because the hardening doesn't stop, right? You see that? Number three, the mass or at least a majority of Jews living at the time of God's special saving activity. You could make an argument for this, but we have to put Jews in the same category as humanity. Because Jesus was talking to the Jews when he was talking about a certain gate. Two gates, actually. Wide is the gate that leads to destruction. Narrow is the gate. What is the implication of that? More go on the wide path. And he's talking to Israel. Wide is the path that leads to destruction. Narrow is the path that leads to life. And few will enter in it, he said. Okay, so to say that somehow all of a sudden the masses or a huge majority of Jews living at the time of God's special saving activity will happen, I don't think the Bible doesn't speak to that. Now, I hope that's the case. I hope that before Jesus returns, there's just this mass of conversion of people coming to faith, both Jew and Gentile. But the scriptures don't give us that sense, okay? The last two, I'm going to argue that one of these two has to be what Paul means. Either it's all elect Israelites within the community of Israel, and I think that's a pretty good argument. I've made that up to this point. When God is God only sees two people. Those who are saved, those who are elect, both Jew and Gentile, and those who are reprobate, both Jew and Gentile. You know, last week I mentioned Elijah, and he's bemoaning the fact that he's the only one in Israel that's still faithful. And God said, no, I have reserved, or we could read it, I have elected 7,000 in Israel who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So, again, even in the Old Testament, not all Israel was Israel. There were hardened reprobates. God called them stiff-necked people and the sort, okay? Or all Israel could be the last one. both Jews and Gentiles, who together constitute the Church of Christ, the Israel of God. And which do you think I actually believe? Number five, yes. Let me see if I can make my case here. Again, only the last two have any merit at all in terms of support from the Scriptures. It's either the elect Israelites in the community of Israel, or it's Jew and Gentile together who constitute new people of God, and God calls his people Israel. So if it is all elect Jews, then this would highlight the mystery aspect. God would have been right not to save the Jews since they rejected Christ, but he did not. However, the context, I think, still pushes us to the last option. Paul says that hardness has happened to part of Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. That's my emphasis there. And in this manner, and so, all Israel will be saved. So I think that Paul's argument here says the fullness of the Gentiles refers to the full number of elect people from among the Gentile nations of the world. But into what do the full number of elect Gentiles come? And I think the answer here is unavoidable. Believing Gentiles come into Israel. As John mentioned earlier, we are grafted into, right? We're wild vines. Some of us are more wild than others. And we get grafted into that vine. And we are branches, by the way, as are Israelites. Who is the vine? Jesus Christ. Jew and Gentile both being grafted into that. I'm lost. Okay, so the fullness of the Gentiles refers to the full number of elect people from among the Gentile nations of the world. So believing Gentiles come into Israel, it is not exactly the point made by Paul. Is it not the point that Paul makes earlier in this passage? Gentiles have been grafted in among the Israel of God. In other words, we become Israelites because we become sons of Abraham. Paul makes that point explicit in Galatians. I told you, most of you probably grew up singing, Father Abraham had many sons. Yes? The whole point of that is that God brings us, who are not ethnic Jew, into his people called Israel. And so that has implications for the way that I'll get to you, John. If I were a good Baptist preacher, I'd say, I see that hand. It has implications for us when we go back to the Old Testament. And I'll just hold it there. John, go ahead, John. Well, they don't. They would say we're reprobate. We're going to hell. Yes, absolutely. The only way that we have any hope is to become an ethnic Jew. And there was a system in the Mosaic Law for a Gentile to become a Jew. He had to renounce his family and his heritage. If he was a male, he had to be circumcised, and he was brought into. But even then, when he came to the temple, he still had to hang out with the non-Jews. He still had to be in the court of the Gentiles. In fact, there's a scene where Paul, there's a riot in Ephesus, and the thought is that Paul had taken one of these converted, or these foreigners who had become Jewish, and brought him into the court of the Jews. And there was a huge riot, even though the man was actually a Jew. So the notion here is that believing Gentiles come into Israel. Old Testament. So I'm reading through the Songs of Ascents, which I preached on a couple of years ago, Psalm 120 through Psalm 134. And part of one of those is a passage that gets, it's the last words in the Passover Seder. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. If I think that I have to preserve and protect that city in Israel, I'm going to... Now, is it wrong to pray for Jerusalem? No, but that's not at all what I think God is intending. God is saying, pray for the people, my people. And so what does that mean? Pray for the church. Pray for the church. Pray that the church would experience peace. That's what Paul says again in Ephesians 4, that this idea that we would experience the bond of unity in the spirit of unity and the bond of peace together, Jew, Gentile, because he had argued in Ephesians 2 that there was a dividing wall between Jew and Gentile, and God brought it down. Because in this new economy of the church, there's no distinction now between Jew and Gentile. In fact, all are Jew. And that was the struggle that the early church had, because for them, if you were a Jew, that meant certain things. You didn't eat certain things. You were circumcised if you were male. And so it caused a conflict in the church, and they had a council meeting at Jerusalem in Acts 15 over those issues. Yes, David. That's right. And the promise he's talking about is the promise of Abraham. It's the same thing in Romans 4 that he had already argued. Again, so Paul's arguing all the way through the first part of Romans that believers are brought into this family of God, sons and heirs of Abraham. Then all of a sudden in 9, 10, and 11, I was kidding. I didn't really mean that. What I really mean is ethnic Israel. And I think it's just silliness to actually think that. We're reading things into the scriptures that the scriptures just simply don't warrant. And again, it has implications. I need to stop. But it has implications in terms of the level of our support for national Israel today. And my argument is, we should support national Israel only to the extent that we support any of our other allies. And they are an ally. And I think we ought to be working with them. We ought to be protecting them. We ought to be helping them. But that doesn't mean that I do it at all costs, because they're still just another kingdom of this world. I mean, for most of Israel, they're just a bunch of secularists. Most of them are. They use the scriptures when it's convenient or helpful for them. Okay? We may have to look at a few things next week, but what I want you to walk away with this is seeing God's glorious plan. That God was bringing a people from every tribe and tongue and nation into this family, and that one day that group of people are going to be a new Jerusalem that comes down out of heaven. That's what we're longing for. That's what we look forward to, and that's to what we ought to be working for. All right, let's pray.